This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello and welcome to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. My name is Mark Hayes, Fellow in Economics here at Robinson. On the 16th of October 2012, our main speaker was Professor John Maloney, who presented his paper on the relationship between the British Treasury and the New Cambridge School in the 1970s, followed by a response from Dr. Graham Gudgeon. John Maloney is Professor of Economics at the University of Exeter and a graduate of Cambridge. He holds a doctorate from Nottingham in the field of economic history and has also worked as a journalist in Iran and as a researcher at the Treasury.
Well, thank you very much for asking me, Mark, and it's always very nice to be back in Cambridge again, where, as Mark says, where I graduated from a very long time ago. The research that this paper's based on was funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and it was a study of macroeconomic policy between 1968 and 1976, but with particular focus on the last 3 years. And the idea was actually to write a book on macroeconomic policy in the Treasury in the 1970s, and unfortunately I found that Sir Douglas Watt, who'd actually been Permanent Secretary of the Treasury, had exactly the same idea, and I did feel if there were two of us at it and only one of us had been Permanent Secretary and it wasn't me, then perhaps I was a bit outcompeted. I did actually buy a copy of his book, and I took it when I went to interview Dennis Healy. I thought it's very kind of him to see me at his age, so I thought I'd take him a present. And he was absolutely delighted with it, and he said, oh, I was going to Douglas's book launch next week. I was only going to get a free copy. I shall now be able to tell him I'm not coming after all. So at least he didn't ask me to carry the message. Anyway, a lot of this is based on some of the Treasury papers that have been released in the last few years under the 30-year rule. And one of the interesting things, I think, is that the people from New Cambridge, or the Cambridge Economic Policy Group, sort of use the two terms a bit interchangeably, but Nicholas Kaldor, for example, was never a formal member of the group. It is very much associated with what's become known as New Cambridge. Were in the Treasury working both for it and against it, you might say, at the same time. Kaldor had already been advisor to James Callaghan in his chancellorship in the 1960s. Wynne Godley had already been deputy head of the government's economic service, but when the Labour government came in 1974, Kaldor and Godley both went back to the Treasury, and Francis Cripps went to be economic advisor to Tony Benn. And when I interviewed Tony Benn in connection with this, he said he had never said anything Francis wouldn't have agreed with. Anyway, what I want to do is to look at the basic New Cambridge model and then look at three issues: what it said about fiscal policy, what it said about inflation, and probably what it's best known for outside, if not inside, the economics profession, its advocacy of import controls. And I think, you know, there will be protectionists for as long as there are free traders, but this is probably the last time that the import controls, the idea of being so seriously up the economic agenda as it was at one stage then. So let me start with, the basic Keynesian income expenditure model. And it is that savings are a function of investment. When I represented as saying savings are a function of income. When I represented as saying investment is not a function of income, of course, Keynes never said investment wasn't a function of income, but he certainly thought it's a fairly unstable function of income, and he thought there were other determinants of investment, such as the rate of growth of income, the accelerator principle, and the level of interest rates, which rather dominated the level of income. So perhaps it's not too much of a caricature to say that if you take the net acquisition of financial assets, the essential New Cambridge concept, the net acquisition of financial assets, savings minus investment, we can take that as being a function of income. Now that was something which the CPG objected to, because it does imply that you get a one-off step change in income, your income goes up 10% or whatever. That doesn't lead you to buy a few more government bonds in line with your additional income. It leads to a perpetual accumulation of assets. Your income is up 10%, you pile up government bonds forever. The Cambridge view was that was nonsensical, and that it was the stock of financial assets, not the rate of acquisition of financial assets, that was a function of, in fact, they saw it as proportional to, the level of income. And therefore, if you first difference that proposition, you get the acquisition of the rate of change of financial assets, acquisition of financial assets, NAFA, was proportional to the growth of income. And therefore, what followed from that was that private expenditure, which is D That's disposable income, by the way, I should have said. Private expenditure, which is disposable income minus net acquisition of financial assets, becomes a weighted average of your disposable income in this time period and your disposable income in last time period, where a time period means... Oh, how do we get to the next page? Oh, there we are. Where a time period is the length of time agents take to adjust their stock of assets, their incomes. And Cambridge research on this found that that was approximately 1 year, or rather what they found was that if you looked at people's incomes, they did not have a significant effect on acquisition of assets for a period longer than 1 year. So they found the research to be 1 year. So what they did, they estimated the basic New Cambridge equation. This is the 1975 version. This is in real terms, by the way. Later they switched to a nominal version. But in real terms, they put in three other variables: higher purchase debt, net increase in bank lending and stock building. But the two key variables, disposable income this year and disposable income last year, the prediction was the coefficients would add up to one. In fact, they didn't quite add up to one, but they did very nearly. So that was the essential equation. And what follows from this was, since, as we've seen, the net acquisition of financial assets is related, it's proportional to the change in disposable income, and since the net acquisition of financial assets is also savings minus investment, and you know, basic national income accounting tells us that savings minus investment, i.e. the private sector surplus, is the total surplus, or the current account surplus, minus the government surplus, or in this case plus the government deficit, we get that relation between net acquisition of financial assets, the current account surplus, and the government deficit. And it therefore follows that the balance of pay, the current account deficit, is the public sector deficit minus a term which is related to the growth of real disposable income between last time period and this time period. So it's not saying that the current account deficit equals the budget deficit. It's not even saying that the change in the current account deficit will equal the change in the budget deficit, but it is saying that fiscal policy must be consistent with whatever the target current account surplus or deficit is. And what it's saying, and I sort of quote the words of the CPG Review 1976, if this equation can be estimated with a reasonable degree of accuracy, then this enables an inference to be made, given the level of public expenditure and the conduct of credit policy, about the full employment yields of the tax system, which is the necessary but not sufficient condition for simultaneously achieving over a sustained period any pair of targets for the current balance of payments and the level of employment, and that the inference, insofar as it relates to underlying trends, can be made independently of external conditions such as the terms of trade. This entirely changes the principles according to which fiscal policy should be conducted. The objection to the use of short-term forecasting as the basis of fiscal policy ceases to be that these forecasts are inaccurate. It is rather that short-term forecasts are the wrong basis in principle for budgetary policy. So what this is saying then is that if the current account target is inconsistent with the employment target, then the two have to be reconciled in some way. One way which you might try to reconcile them is to go for a lower exchange rate, which presumably will both raise employment and improve the current account. But the Cambridge criticism of that, well, not just the Cambridge criticism, but particularly Cambridge economists were sceptical about this at the time. First of all, they thought it was hard to engineer under a floating regime. The trouble with a managed float is you might not get there, and the other trouble is someone may be trying to manage exactly the same float the other way. Secondly, they thought that the real effects are liable to be undone by real wage resistance. Let the pound depreciate, import prices go up, real wages go down, and workers make big money pay claims to compensate for this, which they're likely to get. Prices go up, and the competitiveness you hope to get from your depreciation is undone, and is undone fairly speedily. And this idea of real wage resistance and the idea that workers have a target real wage, I think, is an absolutely essential part of the sort of Cambridge thinking at that time. It's one which I want to come back to. Thirdly, I think, quite apart, leaving aside real wage resistance, the CPG tended to be elasticity pessimists anyway. The general figure that was floating round, I think the OECD put it forward, and Michael Cosmer certainly put it forward in his time at the Treasury, that the price elasticity of demand for exports was around 2, or rather was around minus 2, was generally regarded by the CPG as far too high. You are not going to get this kind of boost to the economy from letting your exchange rate depreciate. So therefore, if you've got this idea, you've got the current account target, you've got the full employment target, but you haven't got a fiscal policy which by itself will meet both, and you're worried about exchange rate depreciation, or not worried, you think that's not going to help either, then in that case there are various things which you recommend. Wynne Godley started recommending credit controls. Well, there are credit controls already, but he started recommending tightening them as far back as 1973, because this might be a way of improving the current account without resorting either to deflationary fiscal policy or to exchange rate depreciation. I was extremely interested to find that at one stage Nicholas Cowdrey was telling Dennis Healey he ought to bring back rationing. This is about 1974. When I lived in Sussex in the 1960s and 70s, our local Conservative MP, Henry Kirby, was forever, it's his stock in trade, telling everybody a Labour government would immediately bring back rationing and everybody would be eating whale meat sandwiches from day one. Became rather a figure of fun as a result. I now found, actually, you know, there might have been something in it, that Cowdrey was quite seriously saying to Dennis Healey, one way of doing this, you know, one way of bringing the import bill down without relying on deflationary fiscal policy and without reducing workers' real wages, which is the key point, might actually be to have some form of rationing. Though he never said very precisely what was to be rationed. And the other one was the idea of import controls, tariffs or quotas, which again, it was hoped could improve the current account without actually reducing workers' real wages and setting off an inflationary explosion. Obviously that's arguable, because if you can't buy the good you want to, you can't buy the import, and you have to have some homegrown version you don't like so much, then you might feel that's equivalent to your real wage going down. But, you know, that's something which was argued about at the time. The important thing is, I think these are all New Cambridge doctrines. The NAFA was a New Cambridge doctrine, with its implication that the balance of payments was much more about fiscal policy than about the level of the exchange rate. The real wage resistance doctrine, that if you lowered the exchange rate, you might not do yourself any good. And the elasticity pessimism doctrine, which said the same thing. Really what they did was, if you put them all together, they all suggested not just that the balance of payments was a potential constraint on full employment, but the balance of payments was likely to be a very chronic and stubborn constraint on employment. Now, that was something which the Treasury would have accepted, because in a sense it was at the root of Treasury policy for about the previous 20 years. If you look back to the so-called stop-go cycle, what was that about? Well, it was almost entirely about deciding you've got to do something about the balance of payments, even if unemployment goes up, and then thinking we can't have this level of unemployment, we've got to do something about unemployment, even if the current account gets worse. Harold Macmillan actually managed to have 4 chancellors, 2 stops and 2 goes, in 6 years as Prime Minister, which must have been a record. The last of those chancellors, Reginald Maudling, and I'm sort of just going back to the sort of policy background now, back to the 1960s. The last of those chancellors, Reginald Maudling, left the country with a huge current account deficit, which contributed to Labour winning the 1964 election, and they immediately rejected the idea of devaluing the pound and tried to struggle on without a devalued pound for the next 3 years. The result of that was that the trade-off between the balance of payments and the level of aggregate demand got ever worse. The amount of aggregate demand you could have and keep the current account under control sank ever lower. Eventually they did have to devalue, and actually by 1969 the economy was running a fair-sized current account surplus. But by that time the threat of inflation had come about. The Labour government had an incomes policy which they effectively tore up in their last few months in power, gave everybody a large pay rise. If they were hoping this would win in the 1970 election, it didn't. Edward Heath came in 1970, and by that time he was already facing an extremely unfavourable trade-off between inflation and unemployment. It was a very unfavourable Phillips curve, if you like. And during Heath's first 2 years, not only was the term stagflation coined, I think, but the term stagflation became a reality with rising unemployment and rising inflation at the same time. And the Heath government effectively pulled every reflationary lever in sight. It was the beginning of the notorious Barber boom, where Anthony Barber, the Chancellor, very much under Heath's orders, tried to push up the real level of aggregate demand by 10% in 2 years. He allowed, I don't think it's a question of conscious decision, he allowed the broad money M3, currency and bank deposits, to increase by 60% in those 2 years, and the pound was floated in 1972 and promptly floated downward sharply, adding to the inflationary pressure. And that led to a pay freeze and then various stages of an incomes policy under the Heath government. Now, a group who were very critical of all of this right from the start were the New Cambridge School of CPG. In 1972, they warned Heath right at the start of his boom, I think before anybody else did, that the boom would produce an unsustainable current account. And if he tried to deal with the current account by deflationary policies which would reduce the consumption of wage earners, then all he would do would be destroy his incomes policy, his wage and price controls, which at the time were the only thing restraining inflation. So that was the Cambridge method. The Heath incomes policy was destroyed by the miners, which caused Heath to cause an election on the Who Governs Britain ticket, which he lost, and Labour came back to power in 1974. Now, I've read somewhere that when Labour got back in 1964, the day after the election, you could barely stand on Oxford Station because it was so crammed with economists waiting to travel up to London to tell the new government what to do. I assume that's an exaggeration, but it did. The 74 election did bring Cowdor, Godley and Cripps into Whitehall, the first two of them advising Dennis Healey. And the situation in March 1974 was dire. Oil prices had risen by 300% in 6 months. There's a current account deficit of £4 billion, 4% of GDP, and price inflation had already just breached the 20% mark and was on the way up, and wage inflation was even higher. Unemployment was still only 700,000. I say only, but that was regarded as a very high figure in those days, but it was rising sharply. And indeed, there was a feeling actually more strongly than the last few years since the financial crisis, that the economic system had broken down. The Heath government had managed to declare 5 states of emergency in its 3.5 years, ending in the 3-day week. And about the time AJP Taylor said, and I rather like this quote, "I've been expecting the collapse of capitalism all my life, and now that it's come, I'm rather annoyed." One of my colleagues at Exeter, well, he's left now, Simon Wren Lewis, was a junior economist at the Treasury, and he told me how in his first week there in 1974, he went to a sort of drinks reception welcoming the new economists, and the chief economic advisor was practically weeping into his whiskey and saying, "Oh God, what do we do?" They really had lost how to tackle this situation at all. So the early years, nobody was very certain what to do, including Healey's Cambridge advisors. And in fact, you can't actually see in the early advice given to Healey much difference between what was coming from Cambridge people and what was coming from non-Cambridge people. Nicholas Cowdor went from do deflate to don't deflate to do deflate in the space of a week, and the advice he gave to Healey, so uncertain was he what to do. In the end, Healey started off with a neutral fiscal policy, but the government's the government's chief economic advisor, Sir Kenneth Beryl, was still worried that Healey was far too liable to be influenced by New Cambridge, and he was not the only person in the Treasury, I think, who would like to have ignored the Cambridge economists altogether. One thing which stopped them from doing so was the Treasury's Public Expenditure Committee, which set up an inquiry into the effect of public expenditure on the balance of payments. And its chairman said, "Essentially, the scope is provided by the proposition set out by Godley and Cripps in the Times in January 1974. The Treasury weren't very keen on this. They thought Parliament should do it properly and have an Economic Policy Committee if it's going to do this at all. So on the whole, it didn't want it to do that either. The Treasury at the time didn't publish their forecasts. They didn't publish the forecasts on which the model was based, and they were not at all inclined to do so, and they certainly regarded this as a nuisance. They were sort of keen to stay out of this inquiry, but weren't able to. The one economist who was in favour of doing so, actually I have a quote which I think is a splendid example of Treasury condescension, and he said he thought they should go along with this parliamentary inquiry because it would be wise to pander to the members' intellectual aspirations. Put another way, the longer the implications or properties of our model are discussed and compared with Mr. Godley's or Professor Laidler's models, the less time there will be for embarrassing questions on current policy or intentions. A reading of the transcripts will show that the hearings frequently take on the characteristics of a tutorial as various members try to sort out various puzzles in their own minds. This will be regarded as a fairly harmless way of killing time. Anyway, when the Treasury sent its submission into the parliamentary inquiry, you can imagine it didn't quite put that, but it just started condescending to Wynne Godley instead and said, "It is laudable that a public committee should inquire into a pressing problem of this nature, and it serves admirably to force officials to focus their thoughts. Nevertheless, it is regrettable to be done in the context of a doctrine that has been presented primarily to the daily press and not any reputable academic journals. A prolonged attempt to elucidate and cope with the implications of the unorthodox and rapidly changing Cambridge doctrine may be felt by some of us to be a misdirection of endeavour. Anyway, they went in there, you know, misdirected endeavour or not. And basically their charges against the Cambridge Economic Policy Group was, first of all, that it had no theory of investment. The idea of net acquisition of financial assets told you what savings would do as a result of investment, but there wasn't anything there about what determined investment. Secondly, they thought it ignored evidence that the overseas sector was a source of instability in the economy. In that, they were accurate, in that Wynne Godley told the same committee he thought the private sector was the main source of instability, not the government, not the overseas sector, but the private sector, and people in the Treasury rather tried to line him up with Milton Friedman on that basis. And secondly, they recognised that the CPG had noticed that the total net acquisition of financial assets had been fairly stable, something anyone hadn't noticed before, but there's a big puzzle there because it's the stable sum of two unstable components. Typically what the personal sector were doing and what the corporate sector were doing, the changes tended to cancel one another out. That's the only reason why you got stability, and they failed to explain this disaggregated fact. They cancelled out for reasons no one had explained. Now, Wynne Godley actually accepted the third point when he gave his evidence. He said that's a puzzle to us too, but he said the Treasury really can make as many criticisms they like. It doesn't alter the fact none of this rehabilitates discretionary fiscal policy in the form it's taken. And nearly everybody agreed with that. JCR Dow from the Bank of England, Lord Kahn and Michael Posner, both from Cambridge, but both critics of New Cambridge, David Laidler representing monetarism. Really, everybody was, you know, attacking the Treasury's continued, in fact, the Treasury continues to be wed to discretionary fiscal policy. But a lot of people who rejected fine-tuning didn't necessarily do so on New Cambridge grounds. So that was the Treasury inquiry. I think it's, you know, from a historical point of view, it's very useful. At the time, it must have been useful as a showcase for different views, but it did come to a notably lame conclusion, which was, do not feel capable of making judgments on the efficacy of the Godley hypothesis and the performance of Mr. Godley's model relative to the behaviour of rival models. And the trouble was, that was exactly what they'd said they were going to do. Instead, their conclusions were the somewhat less than earth-shaking ones. First of all, people shouldn't say inflation when they really meant reflation, and secondly, that the Treasury and the CEPG should hold joint seminars. Well, the Treasury did eventually hold joint seminars with the CEPG, though it took them some time, and in these seminars, they took issue with what they saw as the CEPG's downplaying of short-term forecasting, because they said if you actually look at your equation, two of the most important things are stock building and credit aggregates, and however hard this is to forecast these in the short run, these are exactly the sorts of things you should be attempting to forecast. And they repeated the criticism that your stable surplus is very interesting, but it's the sum of two unstable elements, and you haven't explained that. The CPG, New Cambridge, came back with the point again that the Treasury was getting stocks and flows mixed up, that it was unreal to think that, have a model based on the idea that when your income goes up, that will lead to an everlasting acquisition or disposition of your stock of assets. They said, if private expenditure did not increase one for one subject to time lags with this private disposable income, it would follow that a step change in the flow of income would result in a continuing rise and fall in the net stocks of financial assets held by the private sector relative to their disposable income. It is precisely this implication built into most conventional forecasting models to which we object. So that was the position. But what I think was, well, presumably interesting to everyone, but what I think is particularly interesting to New Cambridge was the fact that the budget and current account deficits, far from dovetailing one another, were moving off smartly in opposite directions by the mid-1970s. The fiscal deficit actually rose from 7.2% of GDP in 1974 to 9% in 1975, whereas the current account deficit shrank from 4.5% of GDP in 1974 to 1.7% in 1975. And the issue was, does New Cambridge still hold? Cowdor was somebody who thought it didn't, and he said, and I quote again, commenting specifically on these figures, on the changes in these figures, Cowdor said, His pessimistic view of the balance of payments has not been shaken by the fact I've been consistently wrong in prophesying balance of payments doom ever since the autumn of 1974, but the intervening period has been one of recession in which New Cambridge does not hold. He thought pessimistic animal spirits had broken the link between saving and investment. The CPG 1976 policy review denied this, denied that New Cambridge had ceased to hold. They pointed out, if you look at the full employment budget deficit with cyclical effects stripped away, it hadn't widened, and if the actual deficit had, this was just a case of automatic stabilisers, it had widened due to the recession. So I suppose here we remind ourselves of what the Cambridge equation is, that the current account deficit is the budget deficit, not equals the budget deficit, but minus a factor which is proportional to the economy's growth since the last time period. So clearly, if growth does move from positive to negative, then this moves from positive to negative, and as a result, you would get a much lower balance of payments deficit consistent with any given budget deficit, and that, you know, was the point. I think, in a sense, the disagreement between Cowdon and the rest of the CPG was a bit semantic. Is this New Cambridge? Is this not New Cambridge? Because they were still recommending the same policies, and in particular, they were recommending with increasing enthusiasm a policy of import controls, which I want to come on to in just a minute. Before I do that, perhaps I might say a bit more about the CPG view of inflation. And it's very simple: deflation makes inflation worse. Workers have this target real wage. If you deflate the economy, Occam's law kicks in. A fall in production means a fall in productivity. A fall in productivity means a fall in the real wage. And a fall in the real wage means an increase in the money wage as workers try and catch up with the real wage, which they feel should be the target. And that translates into an increase in prices. So there are two halves in this hypothesis. First of all, deflation is inflationary. Three bits, really. Deflation is inflationary in terms of the pay claims workers are now going to go for. Secondly, workers will normally get those pay claims. And third, those pay claims will translate into price increases. And in particular, anybody who said, well, they won't entirely translate into price increases because if you're in a recession, firms will cut their profit margins. It's the precise point of the study by Godley, Coutts and Lordhouse, 1972, Pricing the Trade Cycle. Their conclusion was this did not actually vary across the trade cycle. And therefore, there wouldn't even be a dent in inflation in the form of people putting a dent in their profit margins. Now, this whole idea actually gained some support in the Treasury, but I think if you actually look at what the Treasury is saying about inflation, and particularly what it's saying about the unemployment inflation relation, the Phillips curve, they were in a muddle. There were a few people there who thought the old Phillips curve was fine and nothing needed to be done about it, but they're very much in a minority. There were other people in the Treasury who thought the Phillips curve was still there to become invisible. There are people who thought the Phillips curve had ceased to exist. There are people who thought the Phillips curve had never existed. There were people who took the New Cambridge position, and there were people who were slowly moving towards the expectations augmented version put forward by Phelps and Friedman. But, you know, nonetheless, there was a very sharp disjunction between the Cambridge advisers in the Treasury and the rest of the Treasury. The Cambridge advisers continued to hold the real wage resistance version. The rest of the Treasury was really wheeling round to the idea that deflation was still an evil, but a necessary evil, and the chief economic advisor in December 1974, for example, Sir Brian Hopkin, wrote in a memo, to check inflation by operating on demand is, of course, a barbarous and wasteful method of achieving the objective. It is only justifiable if, as a community, we are insufficiently enlightened or have insufficient sense of community interest to accept restraint on the pursuit of individual or group money incomes, whichever is the alternative. Nevertheless, realism forces one to admit that the degree of enlightenment is inadequate. So there was now a definite difference between those who say deflation will make inflation worse and those who are reluctantly coming round to the idea that deflation was the only way to tackle the inflation. So let's now, you know, come on to the thing which the New Cambridge School is most sort of famously associated with, you know, the idea that you should do away, well, no one's ever had complete free trade anyway, but you should move further away from free trade with a form of import controls, either in the form of tariffs or in the form of quotas. And this message was really not coming across very loudly at the beginning, partly because it was recognised that all the oil importing countries are in the same boat. and have a kind of beggar my neighbour policy where I try and import less than you when you're in exactly the same position as I am was not seen as a good idea. I think by the end of 1974, when a lot of oil importing countries, for whatever reason, had been a lot more successful in correcting their balance of payments deficits than the UK, then it did become more reasonable to present the UK as a sort of special case. Obviously, it was recognised if everybody had import controls at once and everybody retaliated, it wouldn't do any good. But it was presented by Godley, Cowdor and others as more reasonable to see the UK as a special case in an especially bad situation, whereby it would be reasonable to impose tariffs or quotas and reasonable not to expect other people to retaliate. I'm not saying they didn't expect other people to retaliate. They put forward an economic argument where they said it would be reasonable for other people not to retaliate. The Labour government didn't really look at import controls very much. They, in the first few months, Dennis Healey's instructions were keep the option open but don't actually do any work on it in case it leaks out. But in December, he called a meeting where the idea of import controls were taken more seriously. And he commissioned a report from a Treasury civil servant, Mary Headley Miller, who I think fairly clearly from this report had made up her mind from the start. Instead of having the case for and the case against, she headlined it. She headlined the sections the attraction and the case against, and when she got to the case against, she announced that the case against was conclusive before she'd even spelt out what it was. So I think, you know, some people in the Treasury were still extremely firmly set against such a policy. But nonetheless, the lines were getting blurred. And Sir Douglas Wass in 1974 actually proposed an import surcharge. I forget how much it was going to be, but a surcharge on all imports. And he proposed it on the slightly convoluted grounds that it would make it easier to push through government spending cuts. And his logic was that if you're going to impose an import surcharge, yes, our trading partners will object, they will complain, they're liable to retaliate. The only circumstances in which they won't retaliate is if they see we're doing something about our economy by cutting the fiscal deficit. So this was Wass's rather indirect reason for wanting an import surcharge, but it was getting more blurred from the Cambridge end, because you certainly find Wynne Godley at the time saying, well, actually, the balance of payments is getting better. We haven't taken any of these measures. The balance of payments has much improved, which it did briefly, but it was only very brief, and by the end of the year, it had gone into reverse again, and the battle lines had opened up again. The Treasury had now come round to the idea of having a policy of controlled depreciation. They realised it was a difficult thing to do, but they decided it was the least bad alternative. The Cambridge Economic Policy Group were more and more firmly in favour of import controls. Godley said, at the end of 1975, there is no exchange rate that will solve our problems. And there, Cowdor got into an argument with Michael Posner, I think I mentioned this earlier, about the price elasticity of demand, which he thought that Posner and the rest of the Treasury were far too optimistic about in the event of an exchange rate devaluation. They got into the econometrics, where Cowdor was doing a cross-section thing and saying, look at all these countries around the world. These are the ones which have had chronic balance of payments problems. These are the ones which haven't. Very few countries, by depreciating their exchange rates, have got themselves out of one country into another. And the orthodox Treasury analysis was really just to take the UK and do a sort of time series and say, well, if you look at the track record of the UK economy, this is when the exchange rate has fallen, and it has actually caused an improvement in the current account. So this went on for a long time. In the end, Brian Hopkin, the chief economic advisor, wrote rather wearily across his copy, no further action in case this goes on forever. And I think this was, you know, more or less regarded as some kind of a draw. But in the meantime, Peter Shaw, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, was proposing a scheme which he tried to sell to the rest of the cabinet by saying, what we will do is we will put tariffs on manufactured goods, but what we will do is we won't try and get the import bill down. What we'll try and do is try and keep the import bill where it is for the next 5 years. And said that if people don't like that and they talk about retaliating, we will say, well, somehow we've got to get our import bill down. We can do it one way or we can do it another way. This actually surely doesn't make any difference to you, how we get our imports down. This is the way which would do us the least damage. Healey was very much against this scheme, as you might expect, and the cabinet threw it out, but it was supported by Cambridge economists and Wynne Godley in particular. By the end of the year, Tony Benn was going for a much more drastic scheme, with proposing 30% tariffs across the board, a scheme which was supported by his advisor Francis Cripps. I think neither Cowdor nor Godley, as far as I can see, commented on this one. But by this time, we were on the run-up to the IMF crisis of 1976. And Dennis Healy actually dug out some new Cambridge figures and used them against Tony Benn. And he said, do you realise that the new Cambridge economists have calculated that if we did bring in import controls of the sort you're proposing, it would require £3 billion worth of tax increases to make them work. The other thing which Healy was doing, though, was he did sort of set up a committee in the Treasury so they could bring in protectionist measures were the IMF bid for an IMF loan to fail. So that there was a plan. There was a plan B. If we don't get this loan, then you know we will have to resort to protection. So let's look at how we might do it. I might say that was not used as a bargaining counter against the IMF, and I think it's very doubtful it would have worked. Very doubtful it would have worked if it had been. So the Treasury had this fully worked out programme. Now, in the meantime, the Treasury had rather changed its attitude towards demand management. It was certainly moving away from fine tuning and discretionary fiscal policy. And one reason was, I think, that it was moving towards the Friedmanite natural rate of unemployment view of the Phillips curve. Now, I can't remember when majority verdicts were introduced in the British judicial system. So I think it was sometime in the 1970s. They fairly knew in 1975. And the Treasury had this rather odd idea of actually taking... They actually had a vote at a meeting. Is the Phillips curve vertical or not? Please raise your hand. Well, they had a discussion beforehand, obviously. Had a vote on whether the long-run Phillips curve was vertical or not, and they decided it was. So here we are. December 1975, accepted vertical long-run Phillips curve by a majority vote. Now, this, in a sense, was a move away from the Cambridge School, in the sense that the Cambridge School, and Wynne Godley in particular, was still extremely hostile to the natural rate doctrine. Wynne Godley wrote an article in the Times about this time and said, if you believe in the natural rate doctrine, you start doing the calculations, you have to believe that the natural rate has risen by a million in the last 10 years, and furthermore, what could possibly increase the natural rate by a million? The only possible candidate is the increase in unemployment benefits brought in by the last Labour government. This is nonsense. You know, statistically, you cannot possibly believe that. So to some extent, the Treasury's movement was a move away from Cambridge, but I think at a sort of deeper level, it moved Treasury towards the Cambridge position because it gave them a much firmer basis for rejecting fine-tuning. If they opposed fine-tuning now, they weren't just saying, well, we'd like it to work, but our forecasts aren't very good and we don't know what the lags are. It now depended on something more fundamental altogether. So I said in the meantime, the Treasury had fully worked out a programme of possible import controls in the events of the IMF loan failing. It didn't use this in the negotiating counter, but the cost of getting the loan was, of course, that there are no import controls. But in 1977, the economy took a considerable upturn, inflation was falling, the public sector borrowing requirement was falling, the economy was growing, unemployment wasn't falling, but most of the macroeconomic indicators were turning in the right direction. And so therefore the government argued that showed import controls had been unnecessary, and it was also said by others that it also showed that the conditions they did submit to reduce the PSBR was unnecessary, because the public sector deficit would have come down anyway, and it was widely seen that the loan itself was unnecessary because hardly any of it was ever used. So really, in a sense, you come full circle by 1977. Just in the Anthony Barber days, 1972 and 1973, everybody's being rather complacent, or most people being rather complacent, with the Cambridge Economic Policy Group sticking out very definitely. By 1977, there was an almost complacent attitude to the economy. We turned the IMF corner, we're not even going to need the loan, the economy is growing again, inflation is coming down, public sector borrowing is coming down, you know, there was no need for draconian cuts, it could have been done anyway. And the Cambridge Economic Policy Group, I think, was sounding out against the general optimism, because they were saying nothing had been done to ease the balance of payments constraint on full employment. That still existed, it was as chronic as ever, and really nothing the government had done or nothing had happened had eased this constraint. And when Mrs. Thatcher got into power after 1979, they felt the view was vindicated, unemployment was rising, the current account was getting worse. But I think it's also possible to argue that to some extent their point had become irrelevant, because this wasn't really a question. Once you got the recession of the early 1980s, it wasn't really a question of a trade-off between unemployment and the balance of payments. They were both getting worse partly because of the rise in the pound. You know, this wasn't a case of will a falling exchange rate work. It's a case of a rapidly rising exchange rate clearly doing damage to both the balance of payments and unemployment. So, you know, the question of a possible trade-off to that extent, I suppose, was less relevant. But, you know, be that as it may, the CPG continued support for import controls, and they were taken up by the Labour Party's alternative economic strategy, which they developed in the early 1980s. But after Labour's loss of the 1983 election, the alternative economic strategy really became very marginalised. And, you know, one has to ask, therefore, what was the long-term achievement of the Cambridge School? I think they certainly did push the government towards a less hands-on attitude to macroeconomic management, but I think Graham is actually now going to, you know, talk about the later days and come in with the final verdict.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan.